Good afternoon. Who's the guy in the suit? You know, I'm a patent lawyer. Who better to talk about such a subject than a dadgum patent lawyer? Open source. Who deals with open source here? Anybody's ever really dealt with the stuff? How many of you ever read the GPL? How many have really, really read it and know what the heck it says? Good. I expect a few questions out of you. I am a free speaker. I like an open forum. Ask questions as you go along. That way we'll be assured that I won't get through all the slides and we'll fill up the time. I will do the best I can to give you a little education as best I can from my perspective as one who has seen open source software from both sides. I've seen it from the perspective of the clients that I represent who are trying to figure out what am I going to do about open source software in my shop, and I've seen it from the perspective of companies who have patents who think that open source software is the worst thing in the world and they want to shut it down. So I'm going to try to present a relatively balanced view, although it will be somewhat difficult to do because I'm a patent lawyer. So I come from that perspective. Let's see if I can make this go. Who am I to be talking about this subject? Well, if this thing will go and I can... Come on, it's supposed to go. There we go. I'm a senior partner at a law firm in Atlanta called Morris, Manning & Martin. I went to Georgia Tech in 1973, so I've been out for a while. Did a little computer design work at Harris Corporation back in the 70s. Worked on many computers when, you know, the computers I worked on were about four times the size of that box. But that was fun. Went to law school here in Emory, MBA. I started in this field in 1979, so I've been exposed to it for quite some time. I'm a registered patent attorney, and I currently practice intellectual property law with a firm, and my field is computers, electronics, telecom, and so forth and so on. I will tell you a little bit more about that later. And my firm, you know, we're supposed to give a commercial, you know, sorry, very brief. We've got 170 lawyers. Well, I'm not going to dwell on that. There is a handout. I think if any of you are interested, if you can read the print, I can't. You know, I'm 54 years old. It's too bloody small, so I hope you can read it better. Maybe you can see some of this stuff. We are, I will say, one of the largest practices in the United States representing technology companies, especially in the Southeast, especially entrepreneurial companies. We are the Southeast leading provider in venture capital deals for technology companies in the Southeastern United States. In the past 5 years, if there's been a VC deal for a computer or a telecom or a software company, there's a 45% likelihood that my firm did it. So we are very heavily involved in funding entrepreneurial companies. If any of you are with entrepreneurial companies, you know, welcome to come and talk to you. We can help find money. Here's a representative list of some of the people we have done work for. A lot of stuff, GuardedNet. Who am I going to mention that's interesting? Forget about it. You may recognize some. We have done a good bit in the Cambia, a good bit in the internet security area. Who cares about that? Who cares about how many patents we've got, how many trademarks? So I won't bother you. But I'll tell you some things you may want to think about. Just because you have open source code in your shop doesn't mean you're immune from patent threats. Patents can come from anywhere. Open source does not mean that you're clear of patents. It is difficult to combine the use of open source software and proprietary software in a firm, in a company. You know, if you're going to be developing proprietary code, and you think that your company wants to appropriate it for your purposes and profit from it, it's difficult to bring in free and open source software. By the way, I'm using FOSS, 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 free open source. I'm going to swap back and forth, so if I start getting into acronyms, that's what I mean. It's difficult to combine those two in the same shop. Now, patents represent opportunities for companies as well as threats, and that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to hold value and represent legal rights, and they're also designed to make life miserable for people That's what they were created for, and there's purposes for them. And, you know, a lot of people don't like patents. We're going to get into a few slides here. There's some problems with the patents in the patent system, no question about it. But they're not going to go away easily. We're not going to readily solve this problem of patents threatening open source software. They're basically in the Constitution, and you'll see that in a few minutes. It's going to take a constitutional amendment to flat out get rid of them, assuming that that's a desirable societal goal. And it's going to take remarkable legislative change to get rid of them. There's a huge entrenched bureaucracy around this country that's just not going to go away very easily, and it's not going to change very quickly. Very clearly, all patents are not created equal. Some patents are very good. A lot of patents are bad. There's just no question about it. The patent system does not create them all equal. The amount of resources that people put into trying to get patents makes a big difference as to whether they're going to be any good or not. A lot of the criticism about patents in the patent system generally revolves around bad patents. And there are lots of bad patents. Some people hate patents, some people love them. Depends on your perspective. Both sides have valid points. This is what I find interesting. Despite all this, even open source shops like Red Hat are developing patent portfolios. I'll show you in a few minutes their stated patent policy if you've not seen it yourself. Is this picking up okay? People can hear me all right? I don't want to hold it too close.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, by the way, I will say also at the end, in June there was a new patent reform bill introduced that purports to change a whole bunch of stuff. Now, whether it does or not, we'll see. Okay. Free and open source software, I think, is a well-intentioned philosophical scheme, and it's what I understand from looking at it when Richard Stallman, when I first encountered him, gosh, 15 years ago in his writings with his organization, open source, he's with, I can't remember, the Free Software Foundation, FSF. The objective of being able to have a chunk of code that you can put out there and have the benefit of thousands of people looking at it and fixing the problems and being able to have a lot of people solving the problems and letting everybody benefit from it, that's a great concept. There's no doubt about it. There is, I think, and many people will think, that there is a place for that. It's a useful place, and it's very helpful to society. Now, there are these undercurrents of anarchy and libertarianism in the free and open software movement. So what? Big deal. I'm quasi-libertarian myself. They've come up with these licensing schemes to try to promote this philosophy under the GPL and the LGPL, which I'll explain in a few minutes to those of you who do not know exactly what that is. They're really a mess. They're problematic to figure out, even for lawyers who study them and look at them all the time, and there are some inconsistencies in them that are very difficult to figure out. Here's also an interesting thing about FOSS as a business model. You know, you're giving away the product. So a lot of companies have a difficulty with the notion that, okay, we're building a product that normally people will sell or license, but yet, you know, you're going to give it away. So how are you going to make any money off of it? Well, typically people who are successful in this have a services business, and they support it, and they bring to bear their expertise and their knowledge and their skill with respect to, I can make this code work because I know what's inside it, and I know how to fix it, and I know how to make it better. And you charge for that rather than charge for the software itself. But interestingly, though, a services business really doesn't care or shouldn't care whether the code they're working on is free or proprietary. You can make an equally good living supporting Microsoft as you can supporting, oh, I said the bad word, didn't I? Microsoft. Anybody here work for Microsoft? Let's have a few cat calls for Microsoft. I don't like Microsoft. Does anybody here work for Microsoft? Good. I don't like Microsoft. I did work for Microsoft. Microsoft is no friend of mine. They fired me once because I tried to give them advice on how they should set up their patent program. And I wrote probably 15 patents for them, and they're some of the better patents that Microsoft has. And they fired me for it. But in any event, we'll talk a little bit more about free and open source software. Now, I've always thought that the FOSS advocates are either victims of a fight. You know, you work for somebody and you kind of, I don't like patents because, you know, I got sued and I lost. There's some truth to that. Anarchists or libertarians. Or sometimes thieves. There are actually a few people who want free software because, well, it's free. And it's, I don't like paying for anything. Some people are lazy. You know, if you got 1,000 people that could work on your project, well, you know, I can just suck something down off the net and that'll work. Or very smart people. I've encountered a lot of really sharp people, and I'm sure some of you in here meet that category. It takes some sharp people to dive into a chunk of strange source code and figure out what's in it and make it better. I used to kind of do that 20 years ago, never been able to. I mean, I appreciate good skilled programmers who can look at a chunk of source code and study it for a while and come out with ways to make it better. That's an acquired skill. Or false advocates are some combination of the above. Excuse me. Which are you?
Lazy.
Lazy? So am I. That's why most of this stuff was free on the net, so of course I downloaded it. I didn't make up any of this stuff. It's all somebody else's. All right, we're going to talk a minute about what are patents and what do they represent. The patent system is designed as a trade-off between two conflicting philosophies in and of itself. One of them is dissemination of technical information to benefit the public. Hey, you know, free and open source software is, one of its purposes is to get the stuff out there so that the information is disseminated to society so lots of people can work on it and make it better. Well, that's one of the stated purposes of the patent system. However, the patent system, of course, has this other little kicker on the other side. In return for granting the inventor a period of exclusivity. So those are incompatible concepts, even in the patent law. And therefore, there is a balance that goes on in our legal system, fending those off against each other constantly. It's a constant battle, and it swings both ways from time to time. Here's another interesting problem of patents. Inventions and patents are expressed in terms of abstractions. They are statements that define an invention that's protected. Well, the abstractions are broad statements. They're not meant to be specific technical statements. They're meant to be abstractions. And the problem is when you start thinking about abstractions, one person's abstraction is easy to think about. Another person doesn't understand why they should get protection for this abstraction because it's too broad and everybody will understand it's obvious, as you will hear about later on, the obviousness standard in the patent laws. To get a patent, you have to meet three requirements. Utility, novelty, and non-obviousness. Utility is easy in the software world. If it runs, it's useful. Utility means useful. Novelty basically means it's new. The exact same thing has never been done before. Where everybody gets hung up is non-obviousness. And we'll get into that in a few more minutes as to what the heck that means, but we won't get into a whole lot of detail on it because that's not the point here. And there is a legal system for determining how patents are going to be granted and whether they're valid. So there is a system in place, unlike in free and open source software, where you can have discussions about what the software does and what the rights are. You know, at least the patent system is a system that's ingrained into our bureaucratic society. So, as you know, patents and open source software are fundamentally incompatible. And we've already talked about this notion of sharing and the benefit of making improvements and spreading that out throughout society. So what are the major objections that I hear about the patent system? Patent system is broken. Broken, well, you know, what the heck does that mean, broken? Well, that doesn't work as great as people would like, but broken would mean it's not doing anything beneficial to society at all. Some would say that that's the case, that it's really a bad thing philosophically to even have a patent system. And we could debate that. But like I said before, you know, there is a bureaucratically entrained system in place, and it's going to be hard to get rid of. Another truism that's an objection. patent examiners are not given enough resources to do a good, thorough examination. That's true. There is no doubt about that. They don't do a good enough job. They're not given enough money. They're not given enough time. They're on a quota system to get patents out. I mean, Dr. Deming, years ago, if anybody ever read Dr. Deming, and his, you know, he's the one who kind of helped the Japanese get out from the ashes of World War II, said quota systems are bad. And the U.S. Patent Office has a quota system. They're only allowed a certain amount of time to get a patent out, and they're only given and that's it. And so if they got a complicated matter, they just don't have enough time to do a good job. The obviousness standard is too subjective. No doubt about that. Litigation in the courts is too expensive. It can cost easily millions of dollars to resolve a patent infringement lawsuit. It's too much. You know, it impedes the progress of software development as a result. Now, here's an interesting little point. These same arguments have been used ever since the patent system began to complain about the patent system. This ain't nothing new. So the complaints really go back 200 years when people were saying, well, why do we need to have a patent system? And it's too complicated, and examiners don't do a good enough job, and they're letting out these worthless inventions. If you go and you look hard enough, you're going to find the same things have been said for almost 200 years. So this is nothing new. No one has come up with a new point that's really worth saying. Is that what else evidence is there that patents impede progress to software patents? There's a recent book out. Well, it's several months old now. I think one of these guys, Jaffe, I think Lerner is a Harvard prof, and I think Jaffe's a Yale prof, and they're economics guys. They're not lawyers. They've done this book about innovation is discontent. And they say the patent system is broken, and it's endangering innovation and progress and what to do about it. It's a good read. It's a good book. I recommend it if you're interested in this area. It certainly gives some good perspective, and I think it's worth looking at. But I contend this. There is no objective evidence in that book that the patent system is broken. Now, it ain't working real good. I will confess that. But when you say broken, it means it has providing no benefits to society whatsoever. Their conclusions, if you look at it carefully, their conclusions are anecdotal. They're admittedly interesting and readable, but there's no empirical evidence in their book, and that's one thing I've challenged them on. I haven't done it in a formal fashion, but whenever I have conversations, I say, well, pull out the book and take a look at it. Where is the empirical evidence? It's very difficult to conduct any kind of a study that would empirically show what the effects of patents are in litigation. Now, you can gather statistics, and people have attempted to gather statistics and say, well, patent litigation costs this much, and these companies have been funded by venture capital, and these companies have been sued, and these companies have this market value, and these companies have gone out of business. So you can have these anecdotal evidence, which is evidence, but it's very difficult to come up with something sufficiently empirical that you can go to Congress and say, here's how it's really broken, here's how it really needs to be fixed. All the fixes that are proposed are typically anecdotal. You know, they're going to make these philosophical changes which swing things the other way, and then you wait for the system to do something, and then it may settle again in another fashion. If any of you who are in engineering will understand about, you know, you make a tweak one way, and then you get overshoot and undershoot until things settle down, and if you've got other effects on the system, you don't necessarily have the system settling at the place you want it to. It settles somewhere else until another tweak is made the other direction. I'm aware of no meaningful objective studies, and I would love to know where they are. If you know of any, would you please send me an email, or would you please contact me and tell me where they are? Because let me tell you, I've looked for them, and if you can find them, I would like to have it because I'm writing a book on it. I've already got a book here on this slideshow, and I've got to get it published now. Except, gee, this was free, and I didn't do it myself. Gee, I wonder if I can do this under the GPL. We'll figure that out. Okay. Like I say, many advocates have formed their anti-patent beliefs without objective evidence. But like I say, there are bad patents and patent trolls. How many know what patent trolls are? I mean, heard that term. Patent trolls?
No. That's when they steal patents.
Patton. Well, oh, I see a troll right there. Now, patent trolls, some people call them patent pirates, and I've seen a few folks out there, too, with pirate outfits on, but a patent troll, patent trolls are the term that's been given to small companies who have no assets but own patents that essentially hire contingent fee lawyers to go and sue to try to get money. That's all there is.
Are these the guys that search for stuff that's patentable, but is in general use and hasn't been patented, and then they try to patent it? And they didn't?
No, that's a different thing. I mean, these are usually small individual inventors who often will come up with a patent and get a patent, and then they're an individual and really won't be able to do much with it. Never produce the product. They'll find a contingent fee lawyer who'll say, "Wow, that looks pretty good. That covers the internet. Let's go and sue." Or that covers eBay. Well, that's one of the examples in here is about this company called Merck Exchange. And coincidentally, a patent lawyer who I don't claim any connection to, I find him quite distasteful because I've seen the guy before, and he decided he was going to write a patent to cover what eBay was doing, and he sued eBay, and they've been in some litigation about it. Anyway, patent trolls have gotten a lot of bad press. If you do Google searches, you will find under patent troll, you'll see a lot of reference to companies that essentially have no purpose but try to extract money from companies, and they're giving a lot of patents a lot of bad names. I agree the patent system is ailing and needs some repair, and this argument also is often put out about patents that 20 years is too long for software and the standards for getting a patent are too loose. 20 years too long for software, we'll talk about it. Probably it's too long, but there are some solutions that the Europeans have. We've said this, patent examiners don't have enough time, and people differ in their views of what should be considered novel and non-obvious. Okay, now, is there any evidence that patents promote progress? Maybe, some. I don't know if this is evidence, but it's certainly a factual statement that the patent system is constitutional. And this balance that I talked about a few minutes ago comes out of this constitutional provision. To promote the progress of science and useful arts, laudable goal for society, right? Congress has the power to grant patents by securing for limited times to authors and inventors. Notice that's where the copyright law comes from, is this author's business. And inventors, that's where the patent law comes from, the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. So this is in the Constitution. It's going to be hard to get rid of. It's very difficult to do a constitutional amendment. Then the patent statute takes that. Congress then imposed a patent statute that says, now you get 20 years of exclusivity. That's this limited times in return for making a full disclosure of your invention. That's the arguable societal benefit of a patent. And like I said a little while ago, it's an attempted balance between incompatible interests. Now, here's some interesting evidence, I think. Also anecdotal, I will confess, but I think it's an interesting piece of evidence. I think the U.S. software industry is not doing too badly. Compare it to everywhere else in the world. I mean, where else? All right, Finland's doing not so bad, but they don't have a whole lot of people. Japan, not so bad. But, you know, where does any real software innovation come from? It comes from this country. It originates here. Now, it may get outsourced to India, may get outsourced to Russia, but most of the seeds and the germs for innovative software products come from people within this country, and then it spreads out. So how impeded can our progress really be? We have a very vibrant software, electronics, and telecom industries. They may not be the strongest in the world, but they're pretty darn close to it. So anecdotally, the evidence would seem to indicate that we're not doing too terribly badly, notwithstanding this horrible threat of patents to open source software. The U.S. patent system, as bad as it is, you ought to see the rest of them. I mean, Europe professes to have a pretty good system, and they do a more thorough job of examination, but they are very clearly taking longer than we do, and it costs almost three times as much to get a patent over there, and there are a lot fewer of them. Are they any better off? Is their industry any better off than ours is? That's hard to say. I don't think so, based on what I've seen from the European economy these days. A lot of useful information comes out of patents. And there are some companies with significant competitive strengths around the world, and some of them have fairly appreciable patent portfolios. Microsoft, Intel, Hewlett Packard, Sun, Cisco, Oracle, Motorola. Those are some fairly formidable technology companies. Okay, now we're going to go into the notion of what the problems can actually cause within the shop. Is a FOSS shop immune from patent threats? Not at all. You don't get any guarantees that you're not going to have patent problems simply because you make a decision within your company that we're going to be an open source shop. Patent infringement occurs from making, using, or selling a patented invention. And somebody that's got a patent doesn't give a rip if you're a FOSS shop or proprietary. They want your money, especially the patent trolls who are giving everybody a fits, patent trolls. That's a separate category that a lot of, you know, I think there's some efforts, as you'll see at the end of this program, there's some efforts to try to put some throttling, try to make a tweak on the patent trolls. And also on the obviousness side. Like I said, threats can occur from trolls, as well as from owners of proprietary software. Now here's some examples of things that I have seen or heard of. Some of these are from personal experience from my law firm, where open source shops or companies that have heavily relied upon open source as a significant component of their servers and their operation. One problem that I've seen occur is that when open source comes to light and it hasn't been more clearly identified early in the process and there's some equity investments being made in a company, you know, the investor says, well, you know, you're going to have this open source stuff. I'm not sure about it. So there's some uncertainty. They're not sure about what it means. Public companies are now required under Sarbanes-Oxley to report any particular problems. Open source is considered one of the categories that needs to be disclosed because it's not necessarily an easy thing to deal with. There are 60 different licenses floating around, roughly, I mean, 60, 58. I mean, I hadn't counted lately, but I think somewhere around 60. Every time an open source product comes into your shop, it's going to possibly have a different license term. And you're going to have to look at it, and you're going to have to scratch your head, and you're going to have to think, well, let's see, now how does this fit in? And if you have different pieces under different licenses, they can conflict with each other. Like LGPL and GPL have certain provisions that are going to conflict with each other. And the LGPL is constructed so when in doubt, just punt on LGPL and just do the GPL, which is a more restrictive version. So you think you may start out, oh, we're going to be an LGPL shop, and you have to punt out of it because you can't figure out how to resolve it. Here are some other natures of problems that patents can cause to a FOSS shop. You can get sued, of course, and if you're sued and you may have to go through a product recall, and that can cost a lot. That's not too good. You may have to rewrite the code. Customers sometimes get skittish about open source unless they know the effect of it or unless they happen to be open source shop themselves and are sufficiently comfortable with it. Code review during due diligence raises questions about license compliance. These due diligence reviews occur often during the financing. Anyway, that planned acquisition, you know, a deal gets killed because of it. Typically, we also see demands for indemnities. A customer will come in and say, so you're an open source shop, will you take all the responsibility for any lawsuits that come out? You know, I'm not going to sign a deal unless you put an indemnification in our deal. I said, well, wait, we're just going to, you know, give you the software. We don't have to license it to you or anything. Well, we're going to have a contract because we want indemnification from you. So you find yourself involved in a licensing negotiation talking about indemnification. And that can wind up taking up more time than anything else, is the discussion about how far you're going to indemnify your customer. Okay, we can skip this part. There are a lot of copyleft issues that come out in open source discussions, especially in looking at licenses. maybe you won't skip it entirely. I will just say that much of the discussion surrounding open source generally revolves around copyright kind of issues, more so than patent issues. Patents are a separate category of problems that can occur. Most open source shops aren't bothering to try to get their own patent, so it's not an issue. It's mostly defending against assertions of patents against you and trying to figure out what the copyright implications are relative to the particular license. And patents, we don't need to talk about that. We can get back to it if anybody's really interested. So if you're an open source shop and you have patents that are asserted against you from trolls or from people owning proprietary software, what do you do? Well, there's a couple of things. Well, one thing is you could give up on it and, you know, license the competitive proprietary software. You can require indemnities from the people you get it from. Just like a few minutes ago said, you know, you're the customer when you're getting software from someone. You could basically say, all right, well, you know, I'm going to use proprietary code here because I know most of the deals with them, you've got recourse back up against the people who give it to you. You can study it, and you can try to figure out a way around it. Study the patents, you know, get opinions from lawyers such as myself and my colleagues. Try to figure out if there's a way around the patents. What else can you do? You can acquire your own patent portfolio to fight back. That's exactly what Red Hat has announced that it's going to do, that it is doing. You can fight back. This kind of relates to conduct a study. You know, if you conduct a study and you determine that you've got a position of non-infringement or a position that the patent's not valid, then you can fight. It costs money, but sometimes a re-examination is relatively inexpensive compared to a lawsuit. But lawsuits sometimes, if your business is significant enough, you know, you go through with it to get rid of them. If you get sued, find lawyers who will be aggressive in pursuing remedies under what's known as Rule 11. That's procedural rules in the courts that if you bring a frivolous lawsuit, that you can get your attorney's fees back. It's not very often granted, and you have to posture in the very beginning to challenge the grounds on which cases are being asserted against you. And if you don't start that process of being aggressive and accusing people of taking ridiculous positions, then you don't have the right to get your money back. It's difficult to get your money back, but if you start early enough, you can sometimes do it. And you can acquire a reputation as not being a pushover. This is something I see increasingly. So, you know, many companies that are getting started, this is where a problem occurs and a lot of people complain, is that, you know, you're getting ready to go into business and you get sued and you got a problem. If you can survive the first lawsuit, you might be okay. It's that first lawsuit that's always the tough thing. If you're successful enough in business, you're going to get sued. There's just no doubt about it. You know, it's a litigious society. I've got rights. I've got my rights. I want my rights. And you're infringing upon them. You're going to get sued. And if your company doesn't fight back at a certain point, you're going to lose in the long run. A company that acquires a reputation of standing up for their own rights and fighting back, even though it's expensive in terms of resources, if you do that a couple of times, you're going to generally get left alone because you're going to acquire a reputation as not being a pushover. You know, you hire the right lawyers and you fight back. You know, that's one of the most effective strategies. It does take significant resources, no doubt about it, but that's the best thing to do, is don't be a pushover. Red Hat, this is my favorite. They publicly assert that software patents impede innovation in software development. That's, you know, that's the official false position. Now, how's this for being complicit? One defense against misuse for software patents is to develop a corresponding portfolio of software patents for defensive purposes. In the interest of our company and in an attempt to protect and promote the open source community, Red Hat has elected to adopt this same stance. We do so reluctantly because of the perceived inconsistency, do you think, with our stance and against software patents, however prudence dictates this position. Well, they're still around. They're not doing so bad. They hadn't sued anybody yet, I don't think. They have. They sued SCO, but that's a totally different thing. We'll talk about SCO in a minute. Whoops. Matter of fact, we're going to talk about it right now. Okay. This is not a patent case, but how many people have heard of the SCO litigation? Well, that seems to be a popular subject here. Okay, it's not a patent case. Well, it's kind of a patent case. Then there's Red Hat versus SCO. They decided to jump in the fray. Hey, I want to play too. And then there's a relatively recent one that's been in the news. It's J2 Global and Catscur versus Magenta. Basically, J2 Global, that's EFAX. Anybody heard of the EFAX folks? Yeah, they're out there now. Okay, SCO versus IBM. It's, you know, fairly close to the watch. It mainly affects, all right, who calls it Linux and who calls it Linux?
Linux.
Although the guy's name is Linus, though, right? So he says, Linus? Well, I've heard it. I hear it every which way. I mean, I've had 50 people say it. It's Linus. It's Linus. It was not a patent case. It's until IBM made it a patent case with a counterclaim. It started as a contract in a trade secret case, then became copyright and patent. Basically, this started with AT&T, who of course came out with Unix, and then they sold it to Novell, and then Novell sold it to SCO, and along the way, there were all these license agreements that AT&T gave to people, and then Novell gave to a few people, and IBM early on, back in the, I think, 94, IBM had talked to AT&T about porting Unix over to one of its 64-bit processors it was putting together. And so IBM has taken the position that it's got very broad, expansive rights under the license it got from SCO's predecessor. So a lot of the fighting is really over what are the rights that SCO actually has, what did they get from Novell and from AT&T, and then what can IBM really do with it? So it's really devolved into more of a fight of ownership than it has been a basic threat to open source software, to Linux, whatever. So there are some significant implications to it, especially on some interpretation issues I'm going to hit here. SCO's position is that any source code added in any way to the software that AT&T licensed to IBM is considered a derivative work. So they're saying basically that IBM, because you added instructions to your version of Unix, that's a derivative work. And therefore, it's proprietary to us because then it falls under our ownership rights and we own the copyright. And IBM, on the other hand, contends that it has the right to add original source code and it can donate it. And that's exactly what they announced they were going to do. They were going to donate the code to Linux. And the principal implication on this, if they get around to it, they may get a ruling on what is the meaning of derivative works under the copyright laws, not the patent laws, under the copyright laws, as respects the addition of new instructions that were not previously present in the Unix operating system. Totally new stuff. And also the word modify, because that's also in some of those terms are both in the GPL. It may have an impact on interpretations of that going forward. So that's what people are mostly concerned about looking there. Current status. The last real action, as best I can tell, and some of you may follow it more closely than I only look at it every 3 to 6 months because, well, not much happens. It's been going on since 2003. The court ruled in February on IBM's motions for summary judgment, and that interesting statement here. The court said, it's astonishing that SCO has not offered any competent evidence to create a disputed fact regarding whether IBM has infringed SCO's alleged copyrights through IBM's Linux activities. So at this point, IBM looks like it's winning. Still, the case is still in discovery. There's some motions and discovery deadlines coming up in the fall, so there'll be some more activity probably in another month or two. There's the Grok Law. Anybody follow Grok Law? That's a pretty good site for information on these. Very good source.
In this case, is SCO requiring IBM to defend themselves as opposed to accusing them and bringing evidence to bear against them?
IBM's defending themselves, yeah.
What I'm asking is normally in a lawsuit, the accuser has to provide evidence that the accused is guilty.
True.
But it seems to me in this case specifically, as well as certain other patent cases, the patent holder or copyright holder or the person who claims this brings an accusation, and rather than saying this is how you violated our rights, they just say defend yourself.
Well, what you're speaking of is what's called the burden of proof issue.
Right.
Now, all lawsuits, basically, and almost all laws that go into the courts, initially assign a burden of proof on someone to go forward with the case and to produce evidence as to their contentions. There are certain things that occur along the way that can cause the burdens to shift. Typically, it occurs when the plaintiff or the initial party with the burden of proof makes what's known as a prima facie case that I hereby win because I've established these facts to a certain degree. Then the burden shifts back to the other side, which would be IBM, to basically say, those facts haven't been established, and here's why. And that's what happens in motions for summary judgment. A motion for summary judgment basically is one party saying, here are some facts that I contend are true based on some information they attach. Therefore, based on this, I'm entitled to win the lawsuit. Then that shifts the burden back to the other party to say, wait a minute, there's a question of fact here that needs to go to a jury. So they have to put forth their own evidence to raise a question regarding the truthfulness of that fact to show that rather than there being a summary judgment, it should go to the judge or the jury to be decided. So it's, it gets all this legal procedural crap, which, I find quite distasteful, even though I'm a lawyer. That's what makes lawsuits so expensive, is lawyers arguing over nincompoop things like, I said A, well, you did not, did two, did not. That's what it sounds like, except they do it in papers and they charge $450 an hour for it. My rate's not quite that high. No, not quite. Okay, the other lawsuit that's getting some fame and notoriety right now has to do with J2 Global versus Majanda. This outfit called Majanda has an open source fax to email gateway, and it's they offered under the GPL. And J2 Global and this outfit called Catch Curve each contributed their own separate patents. They've got this little joint thing going here, which is kind of interesting. They're kind of conspiring together with their own individual patents to sue Majanda. There's two other outfits in it. I don't remember exactly what their names are, but they've got this patent infringement lawsuit kicked off. Interestingly enough, J2 Global and SCO have common investors. So there's a little sneakiness going on here. Those guys are in cahoots somehow. And the case has just begun, so it's going to be a while before there's anything meaningful coming out of it. But it's really the most significant purely open source patent case floating around, unless somebody knows of another. No volunteers? Okay, I don't know. I've looked and haven't found anything else.
Umbrella Corp's got a patent portfolio of 4,000 things that are waiting, that are lurking and wait for us.
What are they called? Umbrella Corp?
They're called Umbrella Corp. Just like the
interesting
sci-fi movie.
I like that. Umbrella Corp.
SEO, they own J2.
I'm gonna write that down.
Edgar's has a great write-up on that.
Which one?
Edgar?
Oh, yeah, the SEC thing.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, now at this point in my talk, I am prepared to shift a little bit to looking at some of the provisions of the license. How much time, where are we time-wise? When do you want me to quit?
You've got about a half hour.
We got plenty of time. We can work all the way through these until everybody just goes absolutely to sleep. And some of this will put you to sleep, let me tell you. Open source licenses. Opensource.org is a good place to get a list of them. They have a fairly comprehensive list of the different licenses. That's where a lot of people will go when they're trying to figure out, well, which license am I going to put under my open source product? But there are four that seem to come around the most often. The GPL, the LGPL, the Berkeley, or BSD, and MIT, they're basically the same, and Apache. Many of these have this kind of anti-patent assertion clause in there, which I think is kind of an interesting notion. If you use this software and assert a patent against it, an open source developer, you lose your rights to use the software. So that's the philosophical statement, is that, you know, under the copyleft principle, I'm going to give you these rights, and I'm basically telling you, you better not do anything with the patents, because if you do, I'm jerking those rights from you. That's sort of the philosophical position of it. So BSD, someone had a comment?
BSD does not have that clause.
No, it does not. You're exactly right.
You may sell a BSD derivative.
BSD is the most wide open there is. You've got probably GPL at one end of the extreme, and you got Berkeley at the other end of the stream, and Berkeley at BSD that's just basically a copyright notice thing. Well, there may be some copyright here, and you just got to tell, and you got to attribute people that work on it. That's it. It's very difficult to think what rights are really granted under BSD. It's more like here's this code, and you can do pretty much whatever you want with it, but you got to put these notices in it. But we'll hit that. I've got a slide on that in here. Now, here's what I think is one of the more interesting legal questions that comes out of this whole discussion. The notion of a license versus a contract. They're not the same thing. What is the difference between a license and a contract? I will confess that for a long time, when I would be working on a license agreement for a client, it was basically synonymous with a contract. There were two parties who were talking about terms to share between, you know, what are we going to do with each other? I'm going to give you this product and this code, and I'm going to support it, and you're going to pay me some money, and you're going to pay me a license fee on a per-seat basis, and we're going to have this provision here to support it. And it was a deal, back and forth. Well, you're going to have to give me an indemnity, and yeah, I'll pay you this money on a monthly basis, back and forth, a contract. But a license is not that, especially under the European notion of the concept. There are certain rights that are granted by law under the copyright laws. The right to make derivative works, the right to distribute the work, the right to perform the work, the right to make copies. All of these are rights that are inherently created by the copyright law. Now, if you own that bundle of rights, you can basically give some subset of those rights to someone else, and you can withhold other of those rights for yourself or to give to someone else. Like if you're writing a book, if you're a novelist, you'd say, well, I'm going to give you the right to publish my novel through this publisher, but I'm going to hold the motion picture rights for someone else. So the concept of granting of rights unilaterally just by you and withholding others is what's known as a licensing concept. There's no mutuality involved with the notion of a license. I can give you a right, and you don't have to give me anything in return. And I can withhold it, and I keep it myself, and unless I've given it to you, you don't have anything else. So a license, when you think of the term license, don't necessarily think there's a contract involved, because there's not. There's this notion of the law giving you the bundle of rights, and then you having the ability to do something with it. There's a question.
So what if I give you these rights under certain circumstances?
That's where we're going. You know, can one attach conditions to the grant of a right? That's exactly what GPL does. I mean, you meet the very smart person category here of the people who are free and open source software advocates. You know, because this is something that I have trouble communicating with a lot of people on, because a lot of people think when they see the word license that there's necessarily a mutual agreement between people back and forth, and that's not the case. A contract or an agreement requires that parties actually agree to something. There's this mutuality consideration. I give you something, you give me something back. If you don't have this mutual back and forth, the granting of consideration in both directions, it's not a contract. So a lot of these open source licenses are really truly that, exactly the problem that we that this gentleman over here alluded to is that, you know, this software is out there to be downloaded under a license. And it has purportedly conditions attached to it. Well, normally conditions to rights only come about by virtue of contracts. So there's a big legal question still floating around as to the efficacy, effectiveness, whatever word. There's a go. That's a good one. Thank you. The efficacy of conditions being unilaterally imposed on the granting of rights in a license. That is not completely resolved in our legal system. Certain provisions are very clearly not going to be covered in a so-called unilateral license. Things going upstream to the other party, such as limitations of liability and disclaimers of warranty. You know, I'm giving you the software, but I'm not responsible. If you got any problem, that's not my problem. Or I'm not giving you any warranty, that's not my problem. If you as a customer want some recourse against the person that sold you the product, that recourse either has to come by operation of law, implied warranties under the Uniform Commercial Code and certain other things, or you got to have a contract with them. I'm not giving you any money until you agree you're going to bail me out if I get sued or I got problems with the code. Things don't work right. That requires a contract, not a license.
That's in the direction of me giving something back to whoever's given me the license, or signed the contract with me. The question that was coming up and that you're heading towards is on limiting the conditions under which a licensee may use something. If we can provide any such limitations at all, we should be able to make one of the limitations, you will not sue me.
That's just another condition, though.
But it's a condition that unless you agree to it, I'm not granting you the right that I solely hold, which is the right to license the use of this code to you.
Okay.
Or,
but it's still just a condition.
And it's just a condition and has to be contract because the law that creates the ability to grant license does not get into that?
Yeah, the copyright law didn't get into that particular provision at all. I mean, it's when you have a law that grants the bundle of rights, arguably the only thing that goes outwardly from that license is one of those rights that were originally created with that law. And when you take something like, well, you can't, you have to go and distribute it now with all these other conditions on it, so I'm going to terminate your license under any patents that I might happen to give you if you don't do this right. Well, that's not one of the rights that's under the copyright law. So you've got this condition that's outside the bundle of laws that were created that arguably start the licensing process, and that's the legal question. What conditions that are outside the bundle of rights that come from a license are going to be considered enforceable under a licensing scheme? Certainly if you have a contract, there's no question. If you get into a contract kind of discussion where you have, let's say, a click wrap assent, and you say, downloading this software indicates, you know, your assent to all these terms here, and scroll on to the bottom line, and, you know, you click here, and I'm going to capture everything about, you know, where you came from and the router that you came from, know exactly who you are, and it's going to be an enforceable contract. That's a lot more likely to be enforced than one of these unilateral license type deals, which, I mean, that's one of the basic intrinsic uncertainties of the licensing schemes under free and open source software, and you know, you got to keep that in your head if you're going to go down this path. Another question.
It's one of the things, like, by opening this package, you agree to all these terms that are included in a enforceable contract?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, those are, you know.
The terms are visible on the outside.
Right? Yeah, the terms are visible on the outside. You know, if you don't agree with this, bring it back. I mean, you'll see, if you'll read the fine print, there's lots of variations, but you know, if you open this and you don't like it, bring it back for a full refund, but you know, everything terminates. Okay, let's see. So, I mean, that's just what you just said. Whoops, didn't I just see that? But there's some uncertainty in some jurisdictions as to the extent to which a click wrap license or a shrink wrap license, you know, they're basically species of the same animal, how how enforceable they are, but generally the thought is those are enforceable. Most places, those are enforceable. There are some places where they're questioned, but most of the time you have to assume that they're going to be enforced. Now, here are the license schemes. GPL. Did I make this up, or did I just download it off the web somewhere because it was free? I'm not sure where this came from. But this paraphrasing of the GPL is as follows. You can have this free software on the condition that any derivative works that you create from it and distribute must be licensed to all under the same license. The notion of distributed work, derivative works is strongly embedded in the GPL. Most of the energy that goes into the GPL and the way it operates is looking at what you're doing to the source code and whether that is going to trigger a condition, one of these conditions that we are not sure exactly how enforceable they are, but it's certainly, they've got lots of conditions in the GPL that basically say, you know, if you're going to be using this stuff and distributing it further and making changes, those are derivative works, and therefore they fall under the scheme of copyright law, because copyright law very clearly says that making derivative works is one of those kinds of things that I still maintain my rights to, and I can either grant them or jerk them back. So in my opinion, the people who wrote the GPL thought very carefully about this and decided that in the license scheme, they were going to have to concentrate on this notion of derivative works to make it operate the way they want it to, so that copyleft really has some legal teeth to it, so that you can actually sue, if you want to, for a copyright infringement for someone who violates those conditions that are attaching to things that are rights that can be granted or withheld under the copyright laws.
Is a copy a derivative work?
Absolutely. Well, no, a copy is not a derivative work, but a copy is, making copies are one of the rights that are created under the copyright laws.
One of the reasons I don't use GPL libraries in my work is because I've read that including a GPL library in software I write, so it may depend on parts of the library, but I haven't modified the library, requires me to GPL my software.
That's pretty much right.
Yeah,
that's the conclusion they want you to have. I mean,
right.
Either you play by the rules that, you know, you got to do it this way, and you got to make it open source, and you got to keep it open source, or you're going proprietary, and then you're out of the scheme. And if you go and you use any of our stuff, you know, you're a copyright infringer, and we're going to sue you, or they have the right.
It's a copy, not a derivative work.
It's a copy
in its existing condition.
Well, there's some scenarios here. I've got at the end of the talk, we've got four little scenarios where we kind of play around with some of those. And if we get there, what do we got, 20 minutes now?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you know, when, what the heck, and who's next anyway? Nobody that's of any interest comes after this, all right? Well, excuse me, there's the other speaker in the back there. I'm so sorry to insult you. Okay, here's what GPL has to say about patents. They have given consideration about the way you're going to license patents. Let's see if I can see how this reads. The philosophical statement, you know, free programs are threatened constantly by software patents. They want to avoid the danger that redistributors of a free program will get their own patent licenses. Notice it doesn't say obtain their own patents. That's a totally different thing. This is mainly concerned with you get a product and it's open source, you get sued, you settle, and you get a license under whoever sues you. To prevent this, we have made it clear that any patent must be licensed for everyone's free use or not licensed at all. So you got, let's say you're an open source shop and you get sued for patent infringement, and you strike a deal with them and you get a license from them. And they say, oh, you got a license now, everything's hunky-dory. Well, and you're going to redistribute that product to someone else. Well, if you can't, and if the people who, the patent owner who gave you their license, their patent license, says this is only for you, exclusive just for you, you know, you can't sub-license it yourself, it's just for you, then you're not able to license it to other people downstream from where you are, your further modifications. Therefore, the GPL says you can't license it at all. And it's all buried in this gobbledygook here. I mean, this is from GPL Section 7, and I'm not sure I can even read that. I mean, it's very difficult, but I'll underline the salient provisions. And I will hit up a few of the big terms. If as a consequence of a court judgment, that's a big magic word, or an allegation of infringement, or for any other reason, conditions are imposed on you. That's a very important. Conditions are imposed. That means there's something that's saying, thou shalt do this. It's not just really and truly allegations. It's conditions have to be imposed, whether by court order, agreement, or otherwise, that contradicts this license. You're not excused from it. If you cannot distribute so as to satisfy your obligations under your license and under the GPL, then as a consequence, you may not distribute the program at all. So that's, you're at the end of the chain there. So meaning you could probably keep doing what you're doing. If you are sued for patent infringement by a patent troll or by IBM or Microsoft or whatever, and you go and make some changes to the program, you can't distribute them any further. One question is, can you keep doing it at all? This says you may not distribute the program at all. That says you can't give it to your customers. You can't give it to your customers. I think that generally, most people will agree you can't give it to your customers either. So you're stuck. You go and settle a patent infringement lawsuit, you can't sell it anymore. So basically they're saying, you better not settle. No, you better not settle. If you're going to be open source, you better not settle, because if you can't pass it on to your customers, then, you know, you can't distribute the program at all. For example, if a patent license would not permit royalty-free distribution of the program by all who receive copies directly or indirectly, then the only way you could satisfy both is to refrain entirely from distribution of the program. So they cut you off. The GPL cuts you off. You go and distribute. You're a copyright infringer. You're subject to the copyleft provisions of the GPL. And there's what I said a minute ago. An actual patent dispute has to be alleged, neither litigated or settled, and these conditions imposed. So there's a lot of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, during the early stages of the dispute, before you've actually had an agreement or a license or you know exactly how far you're going to go. You just don't know what the impact is going to be on your business. So that's kind of a problem. So needless to say, that uncertainty triggers a lot of discussion and analysis of the provisions of the GPL. Now, what about the LGPL? It's a little better in some respects. But you think you got gobbledygook in the GPL, wait till you see what I'm going to come up with here. I mean, this is even better. Lesser versus library. You know, it started out as library, and then now it's called lesser. Who knows? Sort of like Linux and Linux. I don't know what the heck it is. They both start with an L. They start out with the same philosophical statement. Software patents are bad. Constant threat to existence of a free program. Can't argue with that too much. We insist that any patent license obtained for a version of the library must be consistent with full freedom of use specified in this license. Not real sure what that means. Sounds good. But it's getting to that same issue again, is that if you get a license from someone upstream that's suing you, then all these provisions are going to be triggered. Let's see, we've already said, most of you probably already know that LGPL was originally for library, and that's where it came from. And it was basically the notion that there should be some way for people to have open source type libraries, but yet still use them in a proprietary program somehow. Maybe, kind of. So a library means a collection of software functions. I mean, this is one of the definitions of, and it's talking about library, and they use the word so as to be conveniently linked. Now, those are magic words in software. I mean, when we talk about linking, you know, what if you exchange XML statements? Is that necessarily linking? I mean, typically linking seems to be more like, you know, you compile it, you know, there's an API, and you make them talk to each other, and then you run an executable, you make an executable, and you got binaries, and it's all like one big chunk of stuff. So it's one big, you know, the binary is one big chunk. Everything's all linked together in the executable. So that's what it sounds like that they were headed for, and as best I can tell from reading about it, that's where it came from, because it's been around for a while as well. Linked, we already talked about that. So, There's also this interesting provision, the LGPL, that the act of running a program using the library is not restricted. Okay, so it sounds like you can hook things up in the library. And you can run it. Sounds pretty good. But it's not quite that simple. This specific question came up recently. What about a proprietary application at one site that interacts with a GPL application at another site that communicates by an XML messages and standard ports? It's not really linking, is it?
Two separate applications, aren't they?
Two separate applications, one would think.
So well, it Linux and Windows on the same network.
Sounds like it's outside the license, doesn't it? Well, this question has been posed to the Free Software Foundation exactly in this form, and they refused to answer it. I mean, they basically said, we'll pay us a fee and we'll figure it out for you. I mean, they just refused to entertain it. And you know, I don't blame them for not entertaining it because they don't want to go and take a position that is going to prove problematic for them later. You know, they're a philosophical organization. They have the goals out there for these purposes, and to go and they don't want to get stuck until they got to get stuck. Question.
I'm chewing on that top bullet item, trying to convert linkage into copyright terms, and I'm having trouble with incorporated into. And I'm thinking about this from my past life as a software engineer. Linking is, in pure computer terms, the act of identifying those things in your code which will at runtime need to make particular API references to another. But in fact, it isn't incorporated, it's called at runtime. It can even be linked against one and then run against a compatible set of published APIs. So I'm not sure that the top bullet is quite right. And then that comes down to the bottom bullet, where because published interfaces that simply transfer data are not ever linked, they're just coded to a public standard. I don't see any question as to the bottom bullet, unless it's just in the legal dotting I's and crossing T's, where you can read it in a way that it wasn't intended.
You'll find that this comes from the LGPL commentary. So it's earlier, it starts out with this linking notion that came up this way. I mean, what you're alluding to, it sounds to me like, is what exactly is meant by linking for purposes of this license agreement. I don't know. It depends on which lawyers are going to say, what lawyers are going to say it means.
It also depends on what year it was written, because I just described something called dynamic linking, which is what essentially all modern systems do. 30 years ago, linkers did in fact incorporate things at link time.
Well, yeah. So you've got all these varying versions of people with different states of software all the time, and you got all these different versions of what linking means. This has not been ever interpreted, and this has never been litigated as far as I know. I mean, no one really knows exactly what it means. You think that's good? Well, you look at this one. Where's my big long one? Well, I'll work my way through it, the next issue. So let's see. Now this is from the LGPL as well. A program that contains no derivative but is designed to work with a library by being compiled or linked. Notice they use compiled or linked at this time. That's called a work that uses the library. And here they will say, and this is straight from Section 5 of the LGPL, such a work in isolation is not a derivative work of the library and falls outside the scope of the license. So they've clearly thrown that part out. And they thought about this this portion of it when they wrote this provision. So let's see. This linkage question, I mean, I think it's one of the more esoteric problems that they haven't resolved, and I'm not going to pretend that I've got an answer for it, because I don't. I mean, I just think it's one of those things that's going to have to be discussed and looked at, and you know, lots of these discussions are going to take place until someone gets involved in a lawsuit and we figure out what the heck it means. I mean, it gets into even more technical detail later on. I mean, If a facility in a modified library refers to a function or table of data to be supplied by an application program that uses the facility, other than as an argument passed, you know, they're starting to get down into the nitty-gritty of passing arguments and having tables that are accessed from the outside. They're even so specific, say, for example, a function in the library to compute a square root has a purpose that's well-defined independent of the application. And this previous subsection requires any application supply. I don't know what all that means.
And that's an excellent point, because something this begins to illustrate that's going to be a problem for the legal system is that, he and I maybe know the difference between explicit and implicit linking in a Microsoft environment, in a Microsoft developed environment. I doubt a lawyer or a judge will.
Well, lawyers will figure it out. Judges have a tough time because they're not going to have nearly the time to think about it. They're going to have two lawyers who are going to be presenting their own versions of what it means depending on what position they want to take relative to their client. You're going to clearly have somebody sometime taking a position that, well, you know, the LGPL had the word linking, and linking means lots of different things. Or you're going to have someone else that's going to say, well, wait a minute, no. Linking has got some very specific meanings downside, and you're going to it depends on the factual context as to where things are going to wind up, because it's going to depend on the positions that parties are going to want to take.
I mean, my concern is at some point this might go all the way to Supreme Court. I don't think Scalia knows anything about compilers versus linkers. And that would be my concern, is are they looking out for our best interest, either being open source developers or proprietary software developers?
Probably not.
So,
you know.
Where's my fate?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, there are a lot of issues that are like that. I mean, the Supreme Court, those people are actually pretty smart people. They are serious about what they do, and they ask a lot of difficult questions, and they have lots of smart law clerks that work for them. And do they get it right all the time? No. But they are charged. If the Supreme Court gets a question like this, they are charged with the responsibility of trying to make a decision that balances societal interest. I mean, they're a balancing act in and of themselves. So they're not necessarily going to make a decision as to the exact meaning of this particular statute as it applies to this particular language. They're going to say, well, you know, societally it's a good thing to have open source software, or it's not. They're going to be making it from a much broader perspective.
Digging for unintended consequences.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What definition of link provides for the general good of the people? I don't know.
Well, I will suffice it to say I don't have answers for all this, but I will continue to say that, in my opinion, and a lot of others, these sections that we've just looked at, and many others in the LGPL especially, are an impenetrable maze of technobabble. And why are they in a license agreement where you're attempting to create conditions? You know, these are more suitable for people who will sit down and hash out an agreement. If you've got a real problem and you need to do something, you need to sit across the table and work through language like this and say, well, let's see how this applies in our context, and we'll agree how we're going to behave relative to each other. The Free Software Foundation and open source software is more, again, this sort of philosophical organization with these license agreements that is attempting to set forth, here's how we think it needs to work for free and open source software to be a viable entity so that people can share code and work on it together. So therefore, here's the GPL and the LGPL and a bunch of these other licenses. Go and live by this and all will be well. Maybe, maybe not. But that's the philosophy. So from a philosophical perspective, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, the goals are laudable, and the implementation of it is awkward. That's about all I can say. And the LGPL, and this is my favorite. The threshold for this to be true, and they're talking about several of these previous provisions, the threshold for some of these conditions is not precisely defined by law. Do you think? Well, it's not. It's just that's why we're having discussions like this. When you have very specific technical problems that you're trying to solve, looking deep into the bowels of the GPL or the LGPL, you're going to sometimes run into questions that are just not crystal clear, and you're going to have results that people will differ on, and that's just the way that it works.
Yeah,
could this simply be solved by claiming that this thing is a click-wrap contract agreement instead of that this is a license? Or does that by itself have consequences, say, in terms of the efficiency of creating the business relationships?
Well, it depends on who you are. I don't think that the Free Software Foundation is particularly enamored with the notion that you're going to do anything other than to follow their license-oriented scheme, because that generally works to promulgate it and to perpetuate the scheme. I mean, that's the plan, and that's the philosophy, is they want to perpetuate the scheme, because at the end of the day, if everyone follows that scheme, then you're going to have a lot of open source software that a lot of people can work on and make good stuff. That's the point.
Could not this essentially the same language done under contract law still promulgate the concept of open source? It's not a negotiable contract. You either take my terms or not. If you tell me you want
well,
to
it's not really
a, go away.
It's really not a, it's a take it or leave it. Yeah, it's a take it or leave it thing. Could they do that? I suppose they could. I don't know. I do not know. I haven't asked Stallman why they done it this way. I mean, that's a good question. Why haven't you made all this click wrap stuff so it's actually an agreement? They haven't done that. That's a legitimate question. Why don't you send them an email and ask them, why don't you make this a click wrap kind of an agreement? And then you can more readily impose terms because it's an agreement. They hadn't done it.
It's been 17 years since I exchanged email with Richard.
Well, he doesn't know who I am, so it doesn't matter. So if you get confused with the LGPL, don't forget that they do have this kick-out clause that says, when in doubt, you can apply the GPL. If you have trouble working your way through all this linking and function calls and these tables and arguments and passing parameters and this and that, well, just give up and do just like we've said here before. Live under the GPL, and all will be well, because then we will promulgate all this henceforth and forevermore. We're out of time. Am I finished yet? Well, gee whiz. I'm not even finished yet. But thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm sorry that I didn't get through with everything. There are some scenarios in here. I'll be glad to stick around, and I don't have any answers, but I have lots of questions. Thank you.